Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com/welcome to now.
This is the Rich Eisen Show.
Let's go!
Live from the Rich Eisen Show studio in Los Angeles.
Was there any thought at all this could have been your last game with the Lakers?
I'm not going to answer that.
If you're the Lakers, do you just say, we're good?
The Rich Eisen Show with guest host Tom Pelissero. Today's guests, NFL Network reporter Mike Garofalo, NBA writer for The Athletic, Mike Vorkunov, NFL Network analyst Chase Daniel, comedian Tom Papa, and now, sitting in for Rich, it's Tom Pelissero.
Welcome to the Rich Eisenless Show. I am Tom Pelissero. Rich is still in New York for what I learned yesterday was new fronts. Until yesterday, I thought that was what Kirk Cousins got from his dentist.
Wow.
You got new fronts.
Are you outing Kirk here for fixing his teeth? What are we doing?
No, he had the gold, the grill that he got, and then signed with the Falcons a couple of weeks later.
He got the veneers like Affleck. You remember?
It's been kind of a forgotten part at this point of Kirk Cousins' offseason. A few things have happened over the past week. I'm sure we'll get into that. Mike Garofalo is going to join us. Chase Daniel, former NFL quarterback, now works with me at NFL Network, does a phenomenal job breaking down these quarterbacks. I'm going to have him get into kind of the scheme fits for all these guys, the Falcons might have liked Michael Penix Jr. Mike Vorkunov going to join us, talk some NBA. And Tom Papa in studio right here, one of the funniest people I think any of us have ever met. And as I learned this morning, a co-star in a movie with TJ Jefferson. Can you give us the quick elevator pitch for Fudgy Wudgy Fudge Face, TJ?
This was a movie. This is a very low budget movie that my friend Harlan Williams shot many, many, many years ago. And from what I can remember, an alien came to Earth. And so Tom and I play these FBI type agents who have to go find a special agent who was our top hunter. He disappeared off the grid. He lives in the desert. We've got to go find him to basically re-enlist him and say, you've got to come back and find this alien. So that was like Tom and I's scene together.
I watched the scene. Your comedic timing, even better than I expected.
I'm not bad, bro, you know.
There were a lot of sound effects in the scene. I think that was, you got paid in Jack in the Box. That was probably because they had to pay the money for the sound effects.
Well, look, Harlan's a friend, and he hit me up. He said, hey, buddy, can you do this for me? And he bought me Jack in the Box, and we drove to the desert.
Jack in the Box.
And we shot this.
That's
and it was awesome.
Yeah.
He's a funny guy. So is Tom Papa. He's going to join us in a little bit on a show that I can promise you will not be delayed by bees. That was my favorite story. We'll talk about Tyrese Maxey. We'll talk about that Sixers comeback. But is it not a bizarre series of events in Arizona to have a multiple-hour delay for a bee colony that shows up at a Major League Baseball game?
This was nuts because I have a couple Dodgers and Diamondbacks on my fantasy baseball team. Yes, I still play fantasy baseball. And I'm just like checking
really
on my...
At it too,
I'm like, why... Why is nothing happening in this game? Like, delay? They're playing a dome. Like, delay for what? And then finally, I see the videos of the swarm of bees and the beekeeper, and they're using, like, a vacuum to, like, suck them up. It was unbelievable.
I've been going so far down the rabbit hole on this story and reading every write-up. Like, the drama with which this is presented... This is from The Athletic. As he settled in for the first inning of his six-year-old son Levi's final T-ball game of the season, Matt Hilton had no clue he was about to make his big league debut. About 30 minutes later, he's at Chase Field, the most popular man in a ballpark that boasted stars like Mookie Betts, Shohei Ohtani, and Freddie Freeman. Tuesday night match between the Dodgers and Diamondbacks got some added buzz when a swarm of bees atop the netting right behind home plate delayed the start time from 6:40 Mountain to 8:35, Colony formed approximately 15 minutes before the scheduled first pitch, forcing Diamondbacks VP of Ballpark Operations Mike Rock into conversations with officials from Major League Baseball. The game immediately delayed as Rock and officials called local pest control companies, including partners Blue Sky Pest Control. They got a hold of Hilton, a branch officer at the company, and told him a swarm of thousands of bees had taken over. They're very close to postponing the game. So, if you're in the pest control business, are you ever shocked by anything? You're at a Little League game and you get the call. The idea that there was a great deal of surprise that, hey, there's nothing that's not an emergency in your business. Mm-hmm. I got rats in the house. All right, I'm going to have to pack up and go. if you choose to be a firefighter and you get the call, you're like, now?
Yeah, like, ah, come on.
I'm at a T-ball game.
Can't just wait like an hour?
Can Bill do it? It's not that big of a fire, I bet. Matt Hilton, though, came to the rescue, broke up. They played Bonnie Tyler's Holding Out for a Hero throughout the ballpark as he broke up the bee colony.
That's amazing.
Last T-ball game of the season, though. That six-year-old, not forgetting. No chance.
No, because you got to think about at six, right? You remember things at six.
Oh, of course.
Right, Mike? You remember six? Like four, not so much. Not five, much. A little hazy. Six, you're starting to remember stuff, and you're always going to remember Dad left the game to go take care of the bees at the Diamondback Stadium.
You got to throw out the first pitch.
That's pretty cool.
At least you got that.
That's
you
awesome.
Got that memory. There he is.
In full beekeeper outfit. What? Incredible.
I mean, he's dressed like like the bees are going to follow him into a like a cult of some kind.
You don't know.
I mean,
you know, get them all some Nikes and have them drink the Kool-Aid, see what happens. That's a heck of a job, though. Matt Hilton.
Wow.
Fantastic work.
Hero of the day.
I'm out here for 2 days. I had to miss my 9-year-old. She put on like a short play.
Oh.
They had like three rehearsals. There was one scene. It was about 15 minutes long. She rehearsed a lot. Did not hear the end of it. Very upset. Wouldn't talk with me on FaceTime last night.
Oh. No way, really?
And I'm not even breaking up the bees here. Oh, I'm just with you idiots. In the studio.
Great use of idiots.
Holding things down.
Great.
Tegan, I'm going to be back later tonight. We're going to watch the scene. If you're watching this right now, you're home from school for some reason. So I'll get the clip. I'll text you the clip. She's got those smart watch now. She can kind of get things. And
I feel really bad
we'll
about that.
Now
you had to miss that.
Yeah,
if it were, okay. See, the problem is now if I actually like explain myself, now this is the part my wife's going to see. She probably is watching right now. And Sarah's like, here come the excuses.
What's up, Sarah?
I don't want to hear it. If it were a whole play, all right, if it were like a 90-minute school production, so that's different. This was 15 minutes. It was very important.
Got it.
I told Sarah, you gotta shoot it on on your phone. I want to see the whole thing.
Yep.
So then she sends me a screen grab last night. Didn't want to send the whole video because Tegan didn't want me to see it till I'm back home. And she's in the front row. She got the camera up, I assume, on a tripod. And the lady who's like two seats over from her does one of these for the whole play. So we've got about 2/3 of the kids. And then we've got the lady who decided that her angle was much more important. So her whole arm is covering up the whole bottom left corner.
Yikes.
I'm hoping I'll be able to see enough. We've got hope. There's always hope. There was hope for the Sixers last night with 28.9 seconds to go. A 6-point game. I really have a strong distaste for. Hate's a strong word, but I really, really, really don't like the win percentage metric.
Yes.
Like,
agree.
Oh, a team scored a touchdown and now they have a much better chance of winning. Thanks, folks. Yeah. We got the best data scientists in America on this. But last night, 6-point lead after the Knicks hit a shot with 28.9 to go. That is, in my mind, that's like your 99.9%. That is if you're feeling good about it, if this game were in Philadelphia, people would have left, right? You're beating traffic. Timeout of 28.9.
Yes.
Just like, let's get out of here. Tyrese Maxey, 23 years old, NBA's most improved player, on his way to a 46-point night, and makes two of the more remarkable shots you're going to see in these or any playoffs. You guys watch more NBA than I do. How do we feel about the foul call on the first of the 2 3-pointers, the 4-point play? I was under the impression we now were trying to disincentivize shooters from, you know, sticking out the leg, leaning into the defender, initiating contact. Is this not, Brockman, is this not Tyrese Maxey initiating the contact on that? I love the story. I'm not complaining about the finish. I'm just saying.
Yeah, and the thing is, NBA officiating has been weird this year. In the second half of the season, they kind of stopped calling that, remember, TJ? But they didn't really announce it. And so scoring was down. Free throw attempts were down in March and April. And then all of a sudden, it's back for the playoffs. Totally fine. Inexcusable loss by the Knicks. First off, get out of the way. There's 28 seconds left. It's a wrap. TNT is showing all the celebrities in the crowd celebrating. Bill Bradley's high-fiving people and Ben Stiller and Jon Stewart. And then, I mean, TJ, you're the Sixer fan. I'm dying to hear what your emotions were like during the last 30 seconds of that game in overtime.
I think at some point, you know, you asked me that this morning. I don't... As much as I love these sports, I've gotten to a point in life where I can't let them ruin me anymore. There were times where these things would ruin me. Like Dallas would lose on a Sunday. I would legit be mad until Wednesday. I had to let that stuff go. So about midway through the third, guys, I was resigned to the fact we're going to lose this game. And then
it's over. The season's over at that point.
In my head, because he's always like, Embiid doesn't show up in the playoffs. And I was literally sitting there on the couch thinking, all right, how am I going to like respond to this guy tomorrow? Because I know this is coming. That was more important to me than the game at that point, because I knew it's coming tomorrow, right? And then all of a sudden, we start creeping back. And then we'll get to the end of the game. Maxey just, bro, there was sometimes I think Tyrese Maxey's almost too fast for his own good. It's like sometimes he runs faster than the basketball. He takes himself out of layups sometimes because he's so quick. But that kid is so good, man, and he's got what they call testicular fortitude.
Say that again, TJ?
Testicular fortitude.
We're just glad we got that in the show twice.
For him to pull up. From what was he, 36, 37?
And he shot it. You talk about going faster for his own good. He's on the run. That looks like that shot looked like when they pull the fan out of the stands and have him take the half court shot for $1 million.
Yeah, right,
it's a full on sprint. The ball's 2 feet out from his body.
But the thing is,
he nails it.
It wasn't like a fan shot. That was his normal shooting,
right?
You know, form.
And also, the Knicks should probably foul in that situation.
Yeah,
you know. So he's like, I got to get this shot up before maybe they foul me with 8 seconds to go.
But are you following him? Are you following him right there, knowing that he might put up the shot?
You're not thinking he's going to pull up from that.
No, you're really not. I was shocked. I mean, I'm sure everyone's mouth was gassed. Just like, what is he doing? All net. It was unbelievable.
And if he misses that shot, the Sixers have literally no one under the basket to even get a rebound.
No one to rebound because they're all in the backcourt.
So he misses that, the game is over.
Over.
Because there's no Sixers under the basket whatsoever. He just pulled up and he hit that shot, and then I went, "Oh my gosh, we're gonna win this game!"
And then still had to go into overtime and keep going. And there were a lot of points scored in overtime as well. You mentioned Celebrity Row and it happening in front of all those Knicks fans. Some of the images, if we can pull those up,
fantastic
from last night post game. So there you got that's Tracy Morgan giving Tyrese Maxey the finger.
I didn't see this one.
Just stone faced Ben Stiller. Looks like he's got a few choice words.
And then Jon Stewart's
and
like...
Jon Stewart got memed in that moment.
Right, I sent it out to Chris and Adam in our group chat. I'm like...
Jon Stewart's tweet, ghost, respect bro. To Maxey, but damn, I'm clearly getting too old for this bleep.
He went full Danny Glover.
Right? He just looked like he saw a ghost at that moment.
Yo, I mean, you knew this image went viral when the Artist Sports Twitter account... Did the comparison, you know, that whatever that guy is incredible.
Oh, he draws the pictures?
Well, no, he finds famous works of art to match sports photos, and he did it on the Jon Stewart screen grab that we just showed last night. Unbelievable. I can't even imagine. It's like they got Reggie Millard again. 30 years later, now they got Maxey.
It's a great celebrities are like us moment, too. And show that Jon Stewart tweet one more time here. Like, the look on his face.
He's just like, what just happened?
I've seen that face one other time, and it was when Florida flipped in 2000 to Bush. Like, that's the last time we saw Jon Stewart looking like that. It's just the pure
like
shock
of
that moment.
To the Cowboys-Packers playoff game last year, I was just like, oh, my God.
Yeah, but that was, they had no chance. That was a, it goes bad from the start game.
That was at the end of the game. My look was at the very beginning. Like, oh, this game, we're not even halfway through the first.
CeeDee Lamb comes off after the first series, like, is tossing his helmet and upset, and you're like, what? Their dad's talking to him. It's like, it's what, like, oh, what's happened here? Over. We got a lot of football to
but
be played.
Tom, that game was a wrap.
It's good for basketball when the Knicks are relevant, and they are definitely relevant right now. I would argue the Knicks having the drama of, are they going to blow this? You posed the question earlier, who's more likely to blow the series, the Knicks or the Bruins?
Yeah.
Both those markets having a relevant team in hockey or basketball. It's good for the attention on the playoffs overall, though you can certainly argue that Boston fans like yourself have had a lot more to cheer for over the last, let's call it 2.5 decades than...
Give or take.
New York fans.
Give or take.
But Tom, listen to Chris's his point of view on this about some kids in Boston who haven't.
Look, man, I mean, they're honestly, there's 4-year-olds who haven't seen a duck boat parade. You know what I mean? Like, what about the kids?
Get those batteries
4-year-olds.
What about the kids?
You've been on a duck boat?
What about the kids? I've actually never done the duck boat tour in Boston.
I did it. I went to BC.
You did it?
I never did it then, but I went back with my wife for a wedding years later. Went on the duck boat. It's kind of fun.
Kind of fun, right?
And I can't swim. I'm not a boat guy.
It's awesome.
But like, you drive right in, and then you kind of float.
Yeah.
And they give you
go around the little bay.
They're saying, over there. That's where they make these candies. No, but there were candies. What are they? The little circle things. They're not sweet tarts. They're like not the good ones. They're kind of chalky. And they're like, that's where you make them.
That was the souvenir
from the duck boat tour. Was a sleeve of these chalky candies. I'm like, that's
I know
totally worth $95
for this. My tongue, but yeah.
Sprees?
No, not Sprees.
No, we're talking. Go 3 steps below. Google what bad candies made in Boston. It's that one, all I remember really from the duck boat tour.
Smarties,
the boat going in.
Yeah, Smarties.
No, they're not Smarties. They're below Smarties.
Smarties are good.
Below Smarties. Right,
let's take a break. We got plenty of time to Google this. Mike Garofolo, he's going to join the show.
Probably
my NFL Network colleague. Right after this, more thoughts on the NFL draft. Mike's based out in New York, New Jersey. What's going on with the Giants, the Jets? How do we feel about them? We'll talk about it on the Rich Eisen Show.
Hey, folks, it's time for the NFL draft, which means for me, I need a good night's sleep, because if I don't have one, I'm just not myself. You know the deal. You know exactly how important it is to have quality sleep. It's a game changer for all of us. So Sleep Number helps me. My Sleep Number setting is 60. My wife's setting is 70. We both get a great night's sleep because we could adjust the firmness of our mattress on each side. Improve your quality sleep because Sleep Number learns how you sleep thanks to their smart beds and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
What's up, everyone? It's Reality Steve, your number one source for all things Bachelor Nation and reality TV. Every day, I'm giving you the behind-the-scenes juice and your info on all your Bachelor Nation stories and also interviewing some of your favorite reality stars. My name has been synonymous with spoilers, but I'm so much more than that. Give me a listen.
The Reality Steve Podcast, part of the Believe Network. Just search BLEAV on YouTube or wherever you listen.
Let's get to it with The Big Lebowski. How were you introduced to that film?
I ran to the Coen brothers a couple of years before that, I guess, at a party, and they said, we're writing something for you. I say, oh, great, because I was a big fan of Blood Simple and some other earlier films. And then I got the script, and I said, what? This is not like anything I've done. Were you spying? Did you crash some of my high school parties? And where did this guy come from?
Was that character based on anybody that you know?
Yeah, it was based on a guy named Jeff Dowd. For them, they used him quite a bit. I met him. He came on the script. I didn't use him too much. I really referenced myself. and the script, you know.
When did you realize that this film would become, in many ways, you can't even call it a cult. It's a classic. It's just a flat-out classic now.
Yeah.
For The Big Lebowski.
I was surprised, because we had a great time making it, and we were all, laughing and you know, thinking, oh, you know, this was a fun movie. We didn't think it was going to be anything like it was today. Mm-hmm. But I was surprised when it first came out and did nothing. It was like, you know, kind of a bomb. And then it played in Europe, and they got it. And then it splashed back over on our shores, and it, you know, he grew to become
as one of our colleagues on this show has a friend who went to a Lebowski bar in Iceland.
Oh, yeah, got a drink. Yeah. We got these. We have Lebowski Fests. I've been to one. I played with my band at a Lebowski Fest. That was my Beatle moment, man. You know, can you imagine? The dude! Playing to a sea of dudes and bowling pins and, you know, moms. It was just totally surreal. Oh, my God.
Welcome back to the Rich Eisen Show Radio Network. I am sitting at the Rich Eisen Show desk, furnished by Grainger. With supplies and solutions for every industry, Grainger has the right product for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Before we get to Mike Garofalo, we do have an answer to the critical question from the first block of the show. What is the name of the terrible candy that is made in Boston that the Duck Boat Tours like to promote that it is a Boston original? The answer is, according to our producer, Michael Hoskins, who jogged my memory, the Necco Wafer.
Necco Wafer.
Which, as soon as I said that out loud, Del Tufo said, what?
It's disgusting.
Disgusting.
It's the worst candy.
It could be the worst candy.
Yeah, I've ever had.
Yeah, it's disgusting.
If you take a Smartie.
Oh, I love Smarties.
And then you go, what if we didn't make it taste like anything?
Oh. And what if we stretch it out and flatten it even more? And,
oh, that's the Necco Wafer.
Been around since 1847.
And that's why it's part of the Duck Boat Tour.
Yeah.
So 1847, I imagine
they taste like they were made in 1847.
Attaboy,
Mike. The options for candy had to be very low.
In 1847?
Like, I don't think Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory was a documentary. I'm pretty sure at that time, there were just not a lot of different places that you could go. And so you're like, oh, this tastes like something vaguely. But also, there's only so many wafers, right?
Gross.
How many wafers do you have in your life? You might have a Nilla wafer.
No.
Right. Every now and then. Those are tasty.
Vanilla wafer, which is the one that looks like
it's Nilla, right?
No,
the Nilla wafer is the cookie. Vanilla wafer is like the long one that's kind of like a waffle.
Yeah.
Well, then what is a wafer? Because I thought wafer just had to be,
I don't know.
It's a circle because you get the wafers at communion.
Right.
Right. With your little mouthwash cup of wine.
Yep. I don't know.
A wafer is a crisp, often sweet, very thin, flat, like
often sweet, unless it's a Necco wafer. In which case, it's like you're sucking on a crayon.
You got communion wafers, spa wafers, Christmas wafers,
the communion wafer.
Pink wafers, Vaughn wafers.
Vaughn wafer. Never forget Vaughn wafer.
Who's Vaughn wafer?
Old NBA player.
Yeah.
So then how would you power rank that? Where does Vaughn wafer come in?
I think he's right.
He's definitely above Necco wafer.
I think he's number two after Nilla wafer.
I don't know. I got to put communion wafer number one personally.
Communion wafer's one for me. I mean, I'm Catholic.
Yeah, you guys are nuts.
You enjoy the communion wafer?
Yes,
it on your tongue and then you taste it for 10 minutes as it gradually goes into your taste buds.
We would actually,
and then you spend
things,
the rest like, of it. You spend the rest of it going.
No, the communion wafers.
No, what kind of wafers you be?
Yes.
I'm Lutheran, so maybe we get we're not quite on the Catholic wafer.
The Nilla wafer. Is really the goat.
I think that was
the
way.
If we had Nilla wafers at communion, I'd go to church more often.
That would give me that.
Our guy Mike Garofalo. transition. You grew up on the East Coast, Mike. Have you you ever had a Necco wafer?
I heard of them. No, I've never. I don't think I've ever had one. Let me look at it. Let me look them up.
All right.
do you like those shoes, by the way? You like those?
Are you buying? Are you buying shoes? You're shopping.
Well, you were going on about the wafers, so
we had a huge wafer item that we needed to resolve.
I've seen them, but I haven't had them. You're telling me they don't taste like anything? They look like they're sugary, just like the Smarties.
They kind of have like a. It's like the outer texture. It's almost like
cardboard.
They've covered up whatever taste they're supposed to have with just kind of an amorphous, tasteless powder. powder of some kind. You kind of get into them. They crunch a little bit. We'll cover the wafers. We'll get back to the wafers momentarily. Mike, you were out here in Los Angeles for NFL Network's coverage of the 2024 NFL Draft. You wore some very loud suits. Enjoyed talking to you from my spot in Detroit. You're based out there. You spend a lot of time. You cover the whole league. You spend a lot of time in that market. You're around the Giants, the Jets. Start out with the Giants here. Everyone in the world wanted to give them a quarterback, whether they were traded up to three, whether they were taking one at six. They end up standing pat if they can't get up to number three. They take Malik Nabers. Give me the state of the Giants and why not taking a quarterback in this draft made sense.
Well, they did. I mean, we knew. Go back to the combine when we were doing the insiders from Lucas Oil Stadium. And which one of you? You asked me, I think, Tom. What's the percentage chance that the Giants take a quarterback?
And then we tweeted it.
Very specific. And I was like, okay, 78.6%. Like, I pulled a number out of thin air, right, just to be funny. And it was like, yeah, the NFL Network tweeted it. All the Giants blogs were like, he says it's 78.7. Like, what would lead you to believe that that was the
pretty
number
high percentage,
that was
Mike.
Actually mathematically legitimate? So, but at the time we talked about it. You know, you tell me. Are one of those teams at 2 and 3 willing to move? Which back then, if you had asked me, and I think I even said it on the show, I'd be shocked if 2 and 3 stayed put. If one of those two teams didn't trade out, which they wound up not trading out. That was the most surprising thing to me. And if you had told me back then those teams aren't moving, I would say, yeah, then it's unlikely the Giants take a quarterback, because are you going to take the 4th-ranked quarterback at that spot once you finally get the 6? So that's kind of where it was for them. And they did make their effort to get up and get Drake May. But 2 wasn't moving, and which would have been an in-division move, which would have been unheard of for a quarterback at that spot. For, you know, we've seen trades within the division elsewhere, but just to see it happen at that top of the draft would have been unprecedented. So, yeah, I mean, they tried their best. At that point, you take a receiver to help Daniel Jones. I know they went into this draft process saying, all right, if we can land a guy who we think is going to be a franchise-changing quarterback, we're going to land that guy. If not, we're going to try to surround Daniel Jones, who they have had confidence in that his rehab will be on track and is on track and will be set for week 1 of the NFL season, at which point he will be the starter. Drew Lock is there, and Drew Lock they have confidence in, and they certainly made a strong move to bring him in as a free agent. During the rehab process, Drew Lock's going to push Daniel Jones. And who knows? After week 1, if Daniel Jones is not playing well, that's up to Daniel Jones, basically. But at this point, they feel like they're confident in him. And they've got a potential game-breaking presence in Malik Nabers. They have not had that since Odell. I know the comparisons are there because of the LSU thing. But this is the kind of piece that they need to get to the point where we thought maybe Darren Waller was going to be the element that was going to open up this offense and lead him to be something you got to worry about. Instead, week 1, they come out and they're more conservative than they were the year before, which I still don't quite understand how we got to that point. So this is the state of the Giants is Malik Nabers needs to be the guy that unlocks Daniel Jones and unlocks this offense right now.
We had Jarvis Landry on the show yesterday, former LSU Tiger like Malik Nabers. I had him give his Mount Rushmore of LSU receivers. He put Malik Nabers on that list. And he was going back, calling back to Dwayne Bowe and guys from yesteryear. And he said, based on not just what he sees, but the sources that he still has in Baton Rouge, he said, this guy is going to be legit. You know, the question really is about Daniel Jones. And you're there, Mike. I'm sure just you run into Giants fans. You've got family members, friends, whatever. Like, what's the environment around Daniel Jones? In other words, are we going to get into training camp and this is going to be nonstop? When is Daniel Jones going to be out of the lineup? Or are people, listen, they're pot committed for $35 million this year. Are people willing to give this a chance with Daniel Jones?
I believe that most Giants fans, just gauging the reaction leading up to the draft, most Giants fans wanted Nabers, which leads to them showing some confidence in Daniel Jones. They haven't seen the full Daniel Jones since he's been here. I mean, John Mara said it himself best when they hired Brian Daboll, or was it Joe Shane? It was one of those press conferences. John Mara spoke to the side and said, we've done everything we possibly can to screw this guy up. Changing head coaches, changing offensive coordinators, haven't had an offensive line, haven't had weapons around him. So we're still at that point with Daniel Jones. Add the ACL recovery on top of that, and you still have a huge question at the quarterback position that needs to be answered. By him playing well and by him coming out and showing that he could be the guy that if you need him to throw 40 to 45 times a game, if you need him to throw for 4,000 yards on a year, that he can be that guy. If you need him to come back at the end of the game and lead you to a comeback victory and throw you to a win, like we saw in his first action when he played the Tampa Bay Buccaneers years ago and he led a comeback victory. And you're like, oh, okay, cool. This is why they picked him sixth overall. He's sort of Eli Jr. Doesn't look like he has a pulse. And then all of a sudden, at the key point in the game, he's making the plays that you need him to make to win the game. That's what we need to see. Now you've got Malik Nabers added to it. You've got them pretty much doubling down. And because this is not the regime that drafted him. That was the other thing. It was like, okay, well, when it's not the regime that drafts you, you come in. It's a quarterback that hasn't blown you away. They can't wait to get their next guy. This would have been the opening for the Giants and the new regime to do that. They did not do that. They had the chance to take J.J. McCarthy, Michael Penix, even Bo Nix if they wanted to. They would have interest in those quarterbacks later in the draft. They didn't have them rated that high. They said, you know what, we're going to ride with Daniel Jones, and they are.
On the Jets side of things here, and of course last year there was so much high hopes. Giants had won a playoff game. They had added Darren Waller, added all these pieces. Everything there kind of goes sideways early. Saquon gets hurt. Line's banged up. The Jets lose their quarterback on national TV after four snaps. Aaron Rodgers is back. This feels like 2024 is, you know, more or less the redo of 2023. There have been some changes on that team. There was a lot of surprise, I think, at least among fans and certain media members, that the Jets go Olufoshinu, not Brock Bowers, with their first-round pick after doing the swap, moving down to 11 with the Minnesota Vikings here. What in your mind, and based on the people you've talked to, was that pick for the Jets all about? Why did they decide adding another offensive lineman in the same offseason where you added John Simpson and you added Tyron Smith? Why was this the right move?
I was confident in very little going into this draft. The one thing I was confident in was that the Jets were not going to take Brock Bowers. Part of that was what we had kind of heard behind the scenes. The other part was that Joe Douglas at his pre-draft press conference called him a Swiss Army knife and talked about what a value he was to an offense. That was a dead giveaway that we are not eyeing up that guy. Because if they were, they wouldn't have said anything remotely near what Joe Douglas said about him. So they brought in, you know, a couple of tackles here, but a couple of guys that are on the back end of their career with injury issues that haven't played full seasons. Morgan Moses has played through some stuff. I don't want to make it seem like he's not willing to play through injuries. He has done that in the last couple of years, but he had that pec issue last year. He had a core muscle injury a couple of years ago. So those are reliable guys if they're healthy. But even if they are healthy, you're not getting them for the long haul, and Joe Douglas continues to try to build up that offensive line. So, yeah, that made sense to me. I thought the Jets all the way were going offensive line. Maybe if some target slipped down. By target, I mean wide receiver. I shouldn't say target. Wide receiver had slipped down there, then maybe that would have been a temptation for them. But not a surprise to me that they go offensive line there. The Malachi Corley pick, which those texts that they showed, the Jets tweeted out of Joe Douglas and Robert Saleh going back and forth, and the Malachi Corley, no matter what, the reference to draft day, apparently real text. Like, I saw that, and I was like, oh, okay, that's the Jets social media having fun. Like, no, those are real screenshots of the two of those guys back-to-back saying that is the guy they wanted. He had a terrific senior bowl. He won the wide receiver of the week, if I'm not mistaken, for whichever team that he was playing for, voted on by the defensive backs, right, which to me is the utmost sign of respect. So he had a good pre-draft run-up. He's been compared somewhat to Debo Samuel. He seems like a weapon in that regard. So, yeah, should be fun. Let's see this Jets offense for more than, I don't know, four plays.
The video the Jets put out of everybody getting on the phone with Malachi Corley, and one after another, Joe Douglas, Robert Saleh, Nathaniel Hackett, they all say, hey, come here and keep playing angry. We want to see that anger come out on the field. Yeah. You mentioned Debo. Yeah. He doesn't physically look like Debo. Like, he's not right as big and as jacked of a guy. But you watch his play style, the highlights. I mean, he initiates contact out here. And Robert Saleh, of course, was with Debo in San Francisco. It makes sense that they think at a tone setter to that room. They kind of hoped Alan Lazard would be that guy. That's why they paid him, besides the fact that he was friends with Aaron Rodgers. But in Green Bay, that was the guy who would dig out a safety, and he was the big, you know, the physical guy. By midseason, he's a healthy scratch because he's not doing those things. Bring in Malachi Corley to maybe push some things forward here. And I imagine that, you know, if you're thinking about where the Jets are going to throw the football this season, Mike, you have more options than you did a year ago, presuming that Mike Williams' rehab stays on track here.
Yeah, Robert Saleh, hold on. What is this? Hold on.
You about to break news here, or you just did you lose the shoes Will that were Harris, in your,
more shoes?
Like, your shopping Will cart?
Will Harris, former Lions defensive back, signing with New Orleans on a 1-year deal.
We could have waited on that one, Mike, but go on.
I saw the alert come through.
Former,
and I had to go
former
chase
BC
it down.
Guy.
Yeah, there you go. See? You just knocked your
okay,
own,
I'm just
your own
saying,
guy.
Okay, just go on.
Go back to Malachi Corley. Yeah. Was it Robert Saleh? That's what I was looking up when that text came through. I think it was Saleh that said if he has a relative, if there's a relative of his on the goal line and he's trying to get into the end zone, mm-hmm. he's going to take out that relative to get there, which is about as much of a compliment as you can get for a guy's physical style and desire to get into the end zone to make that happen. Now he's calling me. This is very important to him that he is calling me. Let me text him right now. You ask the next question. Go ahead.
Mike Garofolo, NFL Media Insider, is our guest. Your guy Howie has two of the top corners. Both fall into his lap in rounds one and round two. Then it seems like the Eagles did not like, hi, and taking a photo there. The Eagles did not seem to have high regard for the rest of the draft, Mike, because it was one trade out, one trade down after another. I believe they got extra third, fourth, and fifth round picks in next year's draft. Take me through what the philosophy was in an offseason where for everything the Eagles did and being, what, 10-1 at one point last season, they don't finish well. Both coordinators gone, major changes on the roster, signed Saquon, signed Bryce Huff. Now, going to the draft, make over your secondary. What's been the guiding philosophy, and what do the Eagles realistically expect they've got for 2024?
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. As I meant to double-check this, because there was so much stuff flying on Saturday, did the Eagles get the – did they trade the fourth-round pick to the Lions for DeAndre Swift and get a fourth-round pick back? I think that's because it was a 2024 fourth-round pick – to the Lions, and then I think they got the fourth round pick back next year. So I think that's what happened. So that's kind of a fun little twist to that whole thing. Yeah, I mean, there was a mix of Howie Roseman saying that we can accumulate capital for next year. He does the best job, I think, of any general manager of addressing now and keeping tomorrow alive as I've ever seen. And I go back to a couple of years ago when they had a rebuilding year and they made the playoffs, right? If I'm not mistaken, that year as they're rebuilding, which was pretty incredible. And they kept stockpiling those first round picks. And then they kicked it a year out when Jalen Hurts showed that, okay, he's got a little something, but we're still going to keep that first round pick in case we need a quarterback. And they wound up being able to use that capital on other positions of the roster because Hurts kept playing above expectations, I would say. So, I think he did a good job of that building up for next year. Their first two picks, it reminded me of, was it the 2002 draft? They took Lito Shepherd, Sheldon Brown, and Michael Lewis
right
in the first two rounds where they said, we need a secondary reset there. And Troy Vincent and Bobby Taylor were their cornerbacks, and one or both may have still been around at the time, kind of like it is now where you've got Darius Slay and James Bradbury, but saying, hey, these are the cornerbacks that we're going to take over. Going forward, I thought their first two picks were outstanding with Cooper DeJean and Quinyon Mitchell. The Quinyon Mitchell one, I just talked to a personnel guy the other day who said, boy, they got to be blown away with that pick right there. Like that's a home run pick. That kid was nails in the pre-draft process from the Senior Bowl through everything he did. And he seems like he's just an incredible competitor. The kind of guy that you want in your locker room and on your roster, especially at a position like that. He's mentally tough. He's a little bit of everything. And I said, why didn't you guys take him? Because it was one of the picks before the Eagles had taken, let's say in the previous 10, we'll call it. Well, no, we're happy with what we did at our spot. But that was one of those where it was like, pretty tempting. That guy's still on the board. And we couldn't believe he lasted as long as he did to the Eagles there at 22. So that I thought was a home run. That was just who was it? It was, it was one of the people I was working with on the show. Was it Bucky Brooks or maybe it was Steve Weish leading up who said, you know, Howie Roseman just poops out four leaf clovers from time to time. And I was like, yeah, there it is right there.
Mike,
I'd love to give credit to whoever gave me that quote. I can't remember which one it was.
You were clearly very engaged. There was a lot flying over draft weekend. Last thing for you, Mike, we've talked about, you know, the shock of the Falcons picking Michael Penix at number 8. That was the shock too, I think, virtually everybody within the league. What else, if anything, stands out to you, whether it was a surprise, something you're still trying to figure out, a pick, a trade that didn't happen? What's another takeaway that you've had non-Falcons related?
It was the whole top 10 that there was no movement. I mean, we thought, so, you know, we talked earlier about 2 and 3, but we thought Chargers want to get out. The Cardinals want to get out. By the time we got to the sixth pick or so, I got a call from a GM as we take a look at the top 10 here. Don't worry, Tom, I'll host. I think it was the sixth or seventh pick by the time we got to that. The GM calls me. He's like, are you surprised that nobody's moving? And I was like, well, are you trying to move? Because if you're trying to move, you called the wrong person. He's like, no. I thought there was going to be all this movement in the top 10. And actually go back to the Eagles. They had made so many calls leading up to the draft to kind of gauge, all right, what's it going to take to kind of get up if it's got to be into the teens or maybe even around 10 or whatever it was going to wind up being. The Eagles got to the point where there were so many offensive players that were being drafted and there was so little movement up top. They were like, we don't have to move. We can just sit here at 22 and we could take who we want to take. So it was kind of, as it was going on, affecting the teams that were behind the top 10 that thought there was going to be all this movement and had a game plan going in. So I think those teams are happy with what slid to them. Certainly if they were looking for defensive guys, you saw Chris Ballard's reaction to be on the Colts internal video where they showed his reaction to getting Laiatu Latu at number 15 overall. So I think a lot of those teams, if they were looking for defensive help or help other than what was being taken, which certainly was quarterbacks up top, I think they were happy with how it fell, but surprised that it wasn't as much action.
Mike, thank you very much. Get back to the shoe shopping, the Will Harris tweet, and the DJ set that I assume you're doing with those headphones on there.
Yeah. No, I'm actually, working for NFL Network today. That's something that
this is work, actually, man. This is
work. Oh, you're not on later. No, I'm working both shows today.
Yeah, so I got to fly back. All right. Thank you very much.
Have a great show, Tom.
NFL Media Insider, DJ, Fashionista.
DJ Mike.
Fills a lot of roles for NFL Network. Coming up after this. Thanks, Mike. We can get him off the screen now. coming up after this. All right. I know Brockman, TJ, Del Tufo still have a lot of questions about the NFL draft. We answered some of those right there with Mike Garofolo. Bring it on after this. Any questions you've got, lay it on me. It's Tom Pelissero in for Rich on the Rich Eisen Show.
Afford Anything talks about how to avoid common pitfalls, how to refine your mental models, and how to think about how to think.
Paula, while certainly you can mess up on $1 million a year, it is far less likely than it is on $30,000 a year.
Right.
I would meet wonderful people that were struggling with a budget that was super tight. It was 100%. You need to make more money.
Make smarter choices and build a better life.
Afford Anything, wherever you listen.
Is it true that you met Lorne Michaels as a vendor at Yankee Stadium, the SNL founder?
Yep.
Is that true?
Geek four. And I was a kid. And my friends told me, that's Lorne Michaels. He came out of the player's gate. And I overcharged him for like three bats and some Yankee shirt. And then when I became a cast member, I gave him back like $14 and some cents. And he said, what's this for? I said, because I overcharged you for some items. He started laughing. He started dying.
This is, when you said game four, like what, the 96 World Series? Is that what that was, Tracy? What do you think?
Let me see what game.
When were you running?
It was a Derek Jeter. No. Manningly, I think Manningly was playing.
Okay, so that was probably like 95 or something like that. Okay, so what were you doing out there? You were selling stuff. So you were
scalping tickets. I scalped tickets. I sold souvenirs and I sold cocaine. And that's when it was $21 a gram. I'm getting 45 regardless of how it go down for me.
So this is true.
I'm sorry, because I live right up the hill. So I had tickets, I had cocaine, and I had souvenirs.
You had it all. That's what you're saying. Back in the day.
$20, $21 a gram.
And so you sold hats and bats and stuff like that. And that's how you met. Isn't that amazing?
Don't forget the coke.
You got something in there,
Rich,
too?
Tracy really was Hustle Man from Martin back in the day.
I really was.
You really was Hustle Man.
I worked souvenirs and I was Tony Montana on the side.
Welcome back to the Rich Eisen Show. Tom Pelissero in for Rich today. Good discussion with Mike Garofolo on a lot of NFL draft issues in the last segment here. We got Chase Daniel coming up on the show in hour two, former NFL quarterback, does a great job on his quarterback breakdowns on NFL Network. So he's going to give us some insight on the scheme fits, the coaching, why some of these quarterbacks do or do not fit in their new homes. But right now, Brockman, I want to kick it back to you. I know you still got a lot more questions for me out of the NFL draft. So shoot, any NFL questions you've got, bring it on.
Let's see. Were you surprised at some of the landing spots of the wide receivers? Coming into this draft, it was one of the best wide receiver drafts we've had in quite some time. We knew who was going to be the top guys. It was going to be Marvin Harrison. It was going to be Malik Nabers. It was going to be Roma Dunze. But after that, what do you think about the fits for some of these guys who went throughout the first round and then to start the second round?
I think Marvin Harrison was the easy one because everybody had a pretty good idea if the Cardinals stood pat, they were going to take him at number four. Malik Nabers, like Garofalo was just detailing, if they weren't going quarterback, that was the sense within the league, is he'd go there at number six. And it does make sense because of what he brings from a football character standpoint. Yes, there's other things you had to take into consideration with Malik Nabers, but from a when he's in the building, in the locker room, on the field, he's that guy, and they needed that presence there. The first one that was even a little bit, I won't say a surprise, but wasn't certain, was Roma Dunze to the Bears. All along, I thought that's the direction it would go because everything that they've done this offseason has been building around Caleb Williams and giving him weapons and giving him support. So bringing him in, as opposed to, for instance, taking an offensive lineman, right, which is another thing that could potentially help him.
Right.
Just kind of knowing the psychology of how they'd proceeded here. That one didn't take me aback, but it was legit. There were people in the league trying to figure that one out. When would Roma Dunze go? He could have gone as high as, if he didn't go to the Giants, number seven, even to the Titans.
Were they always keeping the pick at nine, or was there a thought maybe they could move down?
There was definitely a thought. They were open to listening throughout the pre-draft process, but there weren't trades up at the top.
Yeah.
And so those opportunities, especially when Michael Penix comes off the board at eight, well, now any chance that somebody's going to trade into your spot to leapfrog the Vikings, unless it's for J.J. McCarthy, mm-hmm, that piece of it goes away as well. And later on, it seemed like it was a lot of the wide receiver needy teams. Like the obvious ones on paper were the ones that ended up taking receivers. Brian Thomas going to the Jaguars. Brian Thomas, that one's going to be fascinating because he was not that alpha male type of guy in the receiver room at LSU. That was Malik Nabers. He didn't have to be. And you know, his play was a little bit up and down, but he was highly productive for LSU. He has tape. When you talk to coaches and scouts, his highlight reel, yes, some of the best stuff you're going to see. It's just down in and down out. Is he always that dude? But for a Jaguars team that totally thought they were getting Calvin Ridley back and then had the rug pulled out and he ends up going to Tennessee, that one made sense. And then you go further down, Panthers jumping up one spot to take Xavier Leggett. That one made a lot of sense. The Chiefs taking Xavier Worthy. I think every mock draft by the end had them taking Xavier Worthy. They didn't have the Chiefs doing it by trading up with the Bills to 28, but they had him taking him at 32. That fit made sense. Keon Coleman to Buffalo. You knew Buffalo needed a wide receiver. We talked about that one yesterday. Ladd McConkey maybe is the most interesting one because I don't know if you're sitting there thinking about the Chargers' needs. Offensive line, they addressed that in round one with Joe Alt. I don't know that you would have put slot receiver.
Right.
Even though, Ladd McConkey play inside and outside. But I don't think you would have had that super high up. Obviously, they had a lot of losses at the wide receiver position with trading Keenan Allen, with Mike Williams moving on. They needed help at that position, but Ladd McConkey's a little bit different in terms of his play style. To me, that says they felt like this was the perfect type of a fit for what they want to do offensively here. And it's going to be fascinating to see. I wanted to ask Chase Daniel about this too, because he played with Justin Herbert with the Chargers. Mm-hmm. Herbert's played for a couple of different coordinators. He's played for Joe Lombardi, who is a Sean Payton type of disciple. It's kind of that advanced evolution of the West Coast system. And then Kellen Moore last year, who comes from a completely different, he grew up under like Scott Linehan and that style of offense. What the Chargers are going to do now and the way that everything is going to come off the run game, you would think based on the history of Greg Roman and Jim Harbaugh, is a different deal now. It could be really good for Justin Herbert, where for the first time maybe in his career, he's not having to be the guy who throws the ball 50 times a game,
right,
and has to throw for 500 yards and is in shootouts. So the defense is going to be a big part of that too. Trying to actually stay healthy, which has been an ongoing issue for them, making the right bets in free agency. But Ladd McConkey, that was the most interesting fit. I said it yesterday. You gave me three names outside of those top three receivers who potentially could be the rookie of the year. I kind of like Ladd McConkey's chances just because he figures to have a bucket of balls in that offense.
What about the offensive lineman? That was another deep position coming into the draft. We saw guys go consistently throughout the first round. What about the landing spots for some of these linemen?
That was one of the first, you know, the first, I guess, mild surprise in round one was that the Chargers went with Joe Alt from Notre Dame and didn't go with J.C. Latham, because there were a lot of people who believe what the Chargers need. They got Rashawn Slater at left tackle. What you really need is like a pure right tackle. And J.C. Latham, there's a photo of me that's floated around social media of me next to J.C. Latham at the Alabama Pro Day. He is the biggest human of all time. And he is a right tackle all day, where, you know, historically, you've wanted your left tackle to be the guy who's got good feet. He might be a little bit smaller, but he's got to go up against the premier pass rusher. That's changed in the modern game, where now some of the best pass rushers are coming off the left side. You have to protect both equally. Right tackles are getting paid close to what left tackles are. But J.C. Latham is like your classic right tackle. And they've got, you know, old school coaches, Jim Harbaugh, Mike Devlin's the offensive line coach. You've got guys you would think that's the direction it would have gone. There's scouts who think Joe Alt, right tackle, might not be a natural fit for him. So that'll be something to track here is, could they move Rashawn Slater?
I was just going to say, they wouldn't do that. Could they? The guy's an
kick
all pro.
Inside? Well, you would think, as it stands now, it's going to be Slater at left, Alt at right. But let's keep an eye on that as things move forward. Olu Fashanu, you know, that was a logical fit for him going to the Jets. You know, that one made a ton of sense. The Titans adding a tackle. I don't think there were any really big surprises. I would say just at number five, all the information, everybody was, you look at the final mock drafts, there were a lot of people saying J.C. Latham to the Chargers. There were a lot of logical reasons behind that. But in the end, they go back to the one who the consensus going into the pre-draft process was Joe Alt's the top offensive tackle. That's probably the guy.
Were they ever seriously considering a wide receiver? You know, from the fan standpoint, it's like, we lose Mike Williams, we lose Keenan Allen. Hey, Malik Nabers is going to be right there. This is a dynamic, you know, playmaker for Justin Herbert. Was that ever in their line of thinking?
Everything that I had heard going into the draft was they were going offensive line. Listen, they want to be a run dominant type of team. They didn't spend a ton on the running backs. They got, you know, they went in with a couple of guys Joe Ortiz knows well and John Harbaugh has been with before. Right. It's Gus Edwards, who signed a pretty, you know, wasn't a minimum deal. It was like a 2-year deal, but it wasn't for a ton of money. And then J.K. Dobbins, who's coming off another season ending injury, been really dynamic. His career average is like 5.6 or 5.8 yards per carry, but just it's been this constant injury bad luck. So why were you going to run the football with those guys? Well, you're going to do it in part with scheme, but you're also going to do it with having the biggest, baddest offensive line that you can possibly put together. They're hoping Joe Alt ends up being a big part of that. What else you got, Brock?
So you, let's see, Chargers, you like them to do what? Back in the playoffs, Chargers? Just like crystal ball it.
It's a unique thing.
All the way out.
Because Jim Harbaugh has been an instant turnaround guy.
Yeah.
I mean,
everywhere he goes.
Go back to San Francisco. Immediately, they are an NFC Championship contender there. They went to a Super Bowl in, I believe, his second year. So the expectations could not possibly be higher. I happen to think Brandon Staley's a really good football coach. He did a lot of things there from like a culture perspective, from a, you know, building out different departments and, you know, all those types of things. But Jim Harbaugh, it's this entirely other deal. Where with Brandon Staley, if they got back into the playoffs and they won 11 games, you'd be like, hey, that's a good season. They're making progress. If Jim Harbaugh goes 11-6 and loses in the first, second round of the playoffs, people are going to look at that and say it's a disappointment. And that's not me putting high expectations on Jim Harbaugh. It's the reality that he's been this turnaround artist. He's coming off a national title. You gave him top dollar for a head coach, and he's running the organization. I mean, the videos are fun. Him singing the Michigan fight song, and he's living in a van down by the ocean. It's, you know, it's all the fun Jim Harbaugh personality stuff. But in the end, you hired him at this stage of his career, and he came back to the NFL because the one thing he doesn't have is a Super Bowl trophy. Yep. The one thing he's not done is hoist the Lombardi. He wants to come back in. He wants to finish the job that he seemed to be on the way to doing when the lights went out in New Orleans. That's the standard.
Eight and a half win total for the Chargers.
Can't give you over under.
John brings his skewed sense of humor. Jeff brings tips to cut strokes off your next round. Together,
It's those weekend golf guys.
They'll pay a lot of money to PXG and Titleist and Callaway and on and on and on. Right? How many yards do you think you're going to pick up with that extra driver? I think I can get an extra 5 to 10. What if I give you 15 to 20? You pay me more.
Jeff Smith right? teaches on the sliding scale.
Those weekend golf guys, the podcast, part of the Believe Network. Just search BLEAV on YouTube or wherever you listen.